This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
There for Sarah, and also the poignancy of her desperately wanting a child in a world of too many children.
That's
around
right.
her.
She wants a child, and she's also very aware of the problem of too many children. So what she wants, her heart is a little bit broken by wanting what she also is aware might not be the best thing for the planet.
Well, tell us what a stud book is, because that's relevant here to Sarah's plight also.
Right. A stud book is a record of animal breeding. It's obviously a captive animal that someone would be keeping track of. The Oregon Zoo holds the International Stud Book on Asian Elephant Breeding, which means that we keep track of who has been bred with whom with a goal of maximizing genetic diversity among a dwindling captive population. People also use stud books in horse breeding and dogs and other things, but with endangered animals, there's a particular poignancy to the stud book because they can only breed so many animals, and some don't do well breeding in captivity, even with all of the artificial or supported means of science, artificial insemination and freezing sperm and shipping it and sending it around the world. It doesn't always work.
And you've really sort of flipped the idea of the stud book on its head and looking at humans, the human stud book in a sense. And this book is really on one level about motherhood. Most of the characters are either trying to have a baby, have just had a baby, or dealing with children and adolescents, a whole nother phase. But it's also a specific subset of motherhood that you're looking at. You're looking at women and their husbands who are wanting children pretty late in the game. So it's a cohort of people who I'm guessing had some ambivalence going forward about the enterprise and so have made this decision at the very last minute. Tell us why that was a dramatically rich choice for you for the book.
Well, I think it is I think you've kind of hit on it. They are toward the end of their reproductive capabilities, and the women are anyway. And that echoes the sentiment of the kind of desperation of trying to breed animals that are also on the wane to me. There's a feeling that something that should come easily and naturally is maybe not so easily achieved. And there's also an element of danger, a little bit of physical danger. It's maybe not the best physical choice for these particular characters.
And it becomes also, because of this choice, that they're in their late 30s and wanting to have children, and really a story about aging and transition as well. I mean, I think that this idea that you have to let go of this former self and leap into this new unknown territory, but when you're that old, you're not 18 and doing it, it becomes a whole different ballgame to make that leap.
That's right. It's much more conscious, too. You're much more aware of who you've been and the shortness of life, really.
We were talking about maybe having you read a section. Great.
Sure. I'll read a short piece from not the middle of the book, but close to the middle. Conception was a harsh business. Slam two gametes together hard enough and you get a zygote. You could potentially get other things too, chlamydia, AIDS, and the rage of human entanglements, the big time energy suck of courtship and nesting, the credit card charge of IKEA baby furniture making everybody a slave to work. That was the cost of copulation. Ben put his arms around Sarah, one hand over her stomach. Under his hand, under her skin, their child was made up of cells dividing and multiplying, creating enough of all the right pieces to build a human. The reproductive act is an unacknowledged death in the face of life. An egg and a sperm had committed their tiny double suicide to create the zygote of the next generation. Sarah and Ben would give up their old lives to make a new one. The destruction of the self in the name of creation is a dead serious bonding.
That's great, this tying together of death and life, the suicide of the sperm and the egg to create the zygote.
That's right.
It's a great image. It seems to me like in literature, when you step back and look at the history of it, that there's, for most of it, there's been a taboo about writing about motherhood in any way but a positive one. The mother is glowing and completed and in giving birth to their child. And it doesn't feel like it wasn't until quite recently that we started going in there and parsing that experience apart and having that be culturally acceptable. But you really dive in and explore the comedy and the tragedy of the people muddling through early parenthood. Was there an antecedent for you, an inspiration in terms of writers who have gone into that realm before, or was it the lack of them that have brought you to that?
I'm sure there is. For me, though, the main impulse behind writing this is becoming a mother myself. And having a lot of thoughts about that giant responsibility. Looking at it, it's such emotional terrain. And I feel like in the literary world, books about motherhood are often shifted over into chick lit, and they have certain pre-made packaging. And they're packaged the way baby showers are packaged and the way maternity clothes are packaged. And none of those things get at what it really means to have a child. People often think they want a child because they want the image we get of Angelina Jolie or somebody very beautiful and in a very cosmetic and sanitized image. And the whole mess of having children is just so bloody and bodily fluids and dangerous and fragile and full of insecurities. And it's not what we see. And I just wanted to write something about that and make it funny. I think it's a funny book, but also make it fragile. I hope it comes across as life being fragile. I feel so appreciative of having become a mother myself, but it's also very overwhelming at times.
I would add that the way you portray it is very liberating in the sense that all of these characters don't really know what they're doing. And I think that's really
right.
True to life, especially probably in America, where we don't have a strong parenting culture. There isn't one way to do it, and we have all of these choices and often are choosing different than our own parents. And none of these characters really have a template, and we're watching them in their struggling in very different ways from one couple to the next, but all ways that, at least as a Portlander, seem very familiar to me.
That's right. Yeah.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Monica Drake about her new novel, The Stud Book. You described Clown Girl as an interplay between anarchy and order, and you had the cop and the clown. And I feel like that is something that also resonates with The Stud Book, in the sense that you have the order of the family and you have the anarchy brought into the known system by the child or by the desire to have a child. Tell us a little bit about that dynamic, because it feels like it's something that you're exploring in both books, obviously in different ways.
I like the way you put that. It is very much something that I worked into Clown Girl, anarchy and order, cops and clowns, and how a person makes life decisions in relation. In this book, I can, now that you say it, I see it really does apply. And I guess I did want to look at the way people make plans for their lives and try to bring about things, but we really can't control it all. So it definitely resonates against this drama.
And Clown Girl is more obviously on its surface a comic novel, but it feels like a lot of that is also translating into The Stud Book in my read, in the sense that you have a real sense of comic timing, and especially around physical humor. And of course, motherhood and infancy is ripe with comic possibilities. Are you looking at any literature, history, or maybe even, I think of Charlie Chaplin, for instance.
Charlie Chaplin is one of my favorites. Charlie Chaplin influenced Clown Girl quite a lot, and Charlie Chaplin actually influenced me in the work I did ages ago when I did just a little bit of theater and performance, which didn't really amount to much, but it fed into my writing later. And I think that kind of physical comedy element is still here.
Well, with especially with some scenes, you know, with diaper changing and breastfeeding, you've done some great scenes that you can just, I could see them as a Charlie Chaplin skit, or if it hadn't been censored.
If Charlie
back in
Chaplin
the time.
Breastfed,
exactly,
which would be hilarious.
Yes, it would indeed. But it definitely you got a visual and visceral sense of the comedy in there, and
oh,
I can see why Kristen Wiig would be so interested in translating one of your books, because in a way it almost feels like. You know, the way Bridesmaids goes into the raunchiness of that whole scenario, that you're doing something from a literary perspective around motherhood, that's a similar, at least a kindred enterprise.
I think maybe a little bit what you're looking at is the idea of women in comedy, which is always kind of interesting terrain. But there is a question of how women relate to their bodies in comedy, and or how women relate to their bodies in general, or how women relate to their bodies in the media. Of course, there's a long history of women's bodies as a form of entertainment value, as long as they look right, you know. And we all know what that right is supposed to be. We all see it on billboards and in movies. And I think part of the liberties I can take as a writer is I don't need to craft Hollywood bodies. I can make the characters I want to make, and I can use any part of their body on the page. It doesn't get an R rating. It doesn't have to make it through the same hoops. And hopefully the characters that I have on the page are women's bodies in service of illustrating what it means to be women in their bodies in a very real way. If that makes sense. After I finished this book, we came into sort of, in the time between finishing it and publication, the conversation, the political conversation around reproductive rights has just grown increasingly absurd, really, and terrifying. And I think it's interesting that this book is coming out against that political backdrop.
That is an interesting parallel, and I also feel like focusing on the physicality of motherhood and child rearing segues well into the theme around the Oregon Zoo and around the ways in which humans are very much animals.
That's
in
right.
a sense,
because
That's right. we think of ourselves so differently. We want to portray this image of it all very neat and rational, and really it is this anarchic, but
right.
also very instinctual.
That's right.
Event that's happening,
and we're all competing for the same resources globally. Although we might not recognize that, we might think some countries are doing well, other countries are struggling. But when pollution from China and Japan drifts over the Oregon sky, you know, we're reminded how every baby is born onto the same planet. When there was an article I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, an editorialist was talking about how the United States is losing the war on population by not having enough babies, while other countries like China and India are pulling ahead of us. And of course, it's laughable to imagine there's some kind of border between babies born in countries, that they are pitted against each other. But along these same lines, people often think in terms of religious borders. They think, there's a go forth and multiply mentality in different religions. You know, if we'll have more Mormons, more Catholics. And I think all of those borders are just, they're fabricated. But I would also erase the border between humans and animals. When there are more humans born, there's less space for animals. And there is a giant benefit to sustaining a biological diversity globally. So although the book's a comedy, I'm making it sound very serious now, but those are my concerns at the crux of this question about childbirth.
It's true that there are all of these questions in the book, but it also is a real sort of raucous, enjoyable read at the same time.
Thank you.
So
good.
It doesn't feel like you're reading a treatise on environmental destruction.
When I say it now, it sounds very serious, doesn't it?
But what about the issue when you're talking about the war around reproductive rights?
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this another issue in feminism around motherhood is culturally legitimizing to a woman. And it's something that a lot of these characters are struggling with, too, I think. You know, the pressure that you have within our own culture to be a mother.
That's right. There are, exactly. There are ideas that motherhood is culturally legitimizing, exactly as you say. There's an idea that part of growing up is becoming a parent, whether a mother or a father, that somehow keeps it, maybe a little bit more for mothers, but I think it's for both genders, that you're somehow not fully grown up until you've moved into that parental role. And I have one character in the book who has made a conscious choice not to have children. There, she gives voice to that question of being viewed in a different light because she has not ever entered into that parenting role.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today with Portland writer Monica Drake about her new book, The Stud Book. Even though this book is very women-centric in terms of the protagonists, there are, I think, really three-dimensional depictions of the men. The men are it seems to me, are mostly failing in their struggling into the transition around fatherhood, but in ways that we can have empathy for and can connect to the issues that they're having. And I was curious how easy it was for you to write from the male perspective.
I really like the male characters in the book. And even one male character is humble. He maybe proves himself unlikable at certain points in the book, but I can actually kind of give voice to some of my own thoughts through Humble's behavior. So I don't feel divorced from Humble, if I put it that way. I don't feel separate from his impulses, although I don't admire his impulses, and they're not my own actions.
Could you tell us what momism means? The issue that comes up around with some of the women and their husbands?
Yes, momism is a term from psychology, and it really is that idea of projecting certain ideas onto your female partner, onto your mother, blaming the mother. There is a conflation of mother and wife into similar roles, but it has a lot to do with blaming mom for everything, but also projecting that mother role onto a wife who may or may not be a mother.
Well, obviously we've talked a lot about how you bring a child into the world, there's a death involved. You're leaving behind mm-hmm. a previous mm-hmm. life, and you're going into a new one. Mm-hmm. Another way that I think the stud book really functions to resonate off of that theme is your portrayal of Portland. You have the portrayal, all these people, because they're in their late 30s, are aware of the Portland that used to be.
That's right.
And they're in a new Portland that hasn't entirely been born. It's in the process of being birthed, and yet they have a longing for this old Portland that, in a sense, represents them before they had to make this decision to have a child.
That's right.
So can you tell us a little bit about the old and the new Portland and how that became a sort of a background character for the stud book?
Well, I've been in Portland a long time. My dad was born and raised here, and I've been here off and on through my whole life. And I have a big nostalgia for the old Portland. And Portland's gained such a reputation now through articles and the TV show Portlandia. And I guess in some ways, not that I was speaking directly back to Portlandia, but I just wanted it was fun for me to give voice to some of the changes that have happened. And as you said, it does represent a younger time, a more childlike time for the characters, and just sort of the infancy of what is still a relatively young city. Yeah, I've got a lot of friends that have been here their whole lives too, and it's kind of fun to get together and grouse about some of the changes. Right, we get to be old timers, curmudgeons. We get to say that we colonize the old man bars for all the hipsters now, right?
As far as being one of the old timers, in a mm-hmm. sense, you're one of the old timers in the writing community here in Portland, because you're one of Tom Spanbauer's first
yes.
students in the Dangerous Writers program.
That's right.
Can you talk about any ways in which his mentorship has informed the way you approached writing this book?
Yes, Tom is wonderful. I was his first student way back in the old days, and one thing that Tom, I feel, really imparted to me anyway, was a big-heartedness and a willingness to help other writers and to sort of be in it together. I always remember the day he said, let's just pile all our rejection slips up in the middle of the table. And it was like this good-spirited way. He put his hand out and sort of conjured up the image of a big pile of rejection slips. And we never actually physically piled up our rejection slips, but the invitation to accept rejection was such a great thing that it made the inevitable rejections that came along over the years easier to take, to say we're all in it together. It's just fine. It's part of the process. He also always said with writing, you just clock in, do your job, clock out, and eventually you'll get a raise. And I kept that in mind for a long time. I still do, but yeah, for a long time.
Well, speaking of the clocking in and clocking out, Clown Girl really was an enterprise that took you many, many years.
That's right.
You put it out in the world, got feedback, and brought it back, and mm-hmm. did a lot of revision. And, mm-hmm. and the stud book has happened over a much shorter period of mm-hmm. time. What is it that you learned to be able to streamline the effort for you in your second novel?
Well, when I started writing, I was writing short stories and occasionally poems. I'm talking about way back in the beginning. And I worked with Tom, and then I decided to go to grad school because I felt like grad school was just the thing to do. I thought, well, I'm loving writing so much that I should get a degree in this. And when I went to graduate school, the focus again was on short stories because the workshop is very conducive to talking about a short story, particularly a short story of a certain length. And so when I graduated from graduate school, I wanted to write a novel, and I realized I had this graduate degree, but I really didn't have the tools I needed to write a sustained piece. And so I had to kind of learn that by trial and error. And there's a world of difference between writing a short story and writing a novel. So that took me a while.
And you're actively involved now in Portland in developing a BFA program for people who are aspiring writers. Tell us a little bit about what that is. I mean, most people don't hear of BFA programs.
That's right. I teach down at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, PNCA, and we've just finalized and gained approval on a BFA in creative writing. That's an undergraduate degree, but it's an undergraduate fine art degree where we treat writing as an art. Students will be taking a series of visual art classes alongside writing classes. So they'll take drawing and basic design and art history while they're taking writing classes. And the whole time we're treating writing as a fine art. The program is built in a way that it can accommodate students who want to write short stories, essays, and novels and poems, the more conventional approach to writing, but it can also accommodate students who are just interested in language and maybe they're interested in working with projecting single images on a wall for a political statement or an idea-driven conceptual piece. Maybe they're interested in painting, but using words on the canvas. We can cross those borders. Maybe they're interested in writing for video or script work or even for games. We've built this program to cast as wide a net as possible in terms of what writing means. It primarily comes down to somebody who is interested in self-expression through prioritizing the word, but you can pull in any other medium.
Well, it feels like the perfect time for that sort of program in the sense that within literature itself, it seems like a lot of the boundaries between genres are breaking down, between poetry and nonfiction, between memoir and fiction.
Right.
People are really playing, and genre fiction's coming into the literary foreground. So to actually bring in like a whole nother artistic genre, visual arts involved, it seems like an obvious evolution to go for writing.
That's right. And with all of the electronic media now, I think people have a natural inclination to bring images together with their own words and to build things that may not look like what we think of as novels in the past. Yeah.
Are you working on any new projects at the moment?
I have another novel in the works. The working title keeps shifting, but I wrote it very fast. I thought it was in good shape, and then I took a look at it. Now I think I need to start chopping it up and moving big pieces around and kind of rethinking the goals of it as a whole. So I guess I'm deep in the thick of thinking through another novel length work.
Can you tip your hand on any of the themes?
It's set down in the desert. I spent a little bit of time living down in Arizona, And I'm drawn back to that, what I consider a very inhospitable climate. As an Oregon person going down to the desert, the sun was just scary. It was just scary. And so it has some of that sense of climate threat, I suppose. It's a little more like Clown Girl in that it's a single first-person narrator and it's a young person basically trying to build a life in a very inhospitable town. It's kind of an outsider position. Yeah.
Well, it was great having you on Between the Covers, Monica.
Thank you so much, David. It's been great. Yeah.
We're talking today with Monica Drake about her new book, The Stud Book. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
The 2013 Yogathon is here, and KABU is a co-sponsor. Living Yoga is holding its fourth annual Yogathon during the months of April and May. Individuals and groups are creating their own personal yoga challenges. They're attending classes at several participating yoga studios in the Portland area, and friends and family are sponsoring their efforts. Living Yoga is awarding prizes to the top individual and team. All of this is to help benefit Living Yoga, a nonprofit program bringing yoga to people in drug and alcohol recovery, incarceration, or who are accessing community transitional services. More information about this six-week-long event can be found at living-yoga.org.
This is Sarah Sneath with KBOO Portland. In the Division of Labor and Society, Emil Durkheim observes that the division of labor occurs when societies become larger and denser. Societies become denser because of the union of groups, development of towns, and or better and more accessible communication technologies. Durkheim likens specialization to Darwin's theory that a species that grows beyond its resources will create war and famine, but varied species that do not feed in the same way or lead the same life are not in competition with one another. We become more dependent on society the more labor is divided up. In a given day, you meet with one person who cuts your hair, another who sells you groceries, and a third who fixes your vehicle. Tasks that you likely cannot do or do not have time to do yourself. Though you may have encounters with several people throughout a day, these encounters are likely brief. In addition to the people who you do encounter, there are hundreds of thousands of others who take out the trash in city parks, write music, and develop software, whose creation you may use, but who you yourself will never meet. All this leading to a more alienated lifestyle.
Will this living on the run will cause the hard disposition?
There's a growing movement in America of people who are dissatisfied, people who desire a business model, a housing situation, and or a kind of employment that does not alienate, but binds them to other members of their community. Tim and Noah Husson, brothers from Florida, bicycled for about 2 years to find these people and tell their stories through a feature-length film entitled America Recycled. The following is a clip from the trailer.
We create our wealth and our happiness from our interrelations with each other. We're able to demonstrate that you can live comfortably and happily consuming so much fewer resources.
We're squatting the house because it just makes sense. If you're hungry, you find food and you eat it. If you're broke, you try to find a way to obtain money. If you don't have a place to live and you don't want to pay ridiculous rent, you reclaim the house.
Small community living has been lost in America.
Yeah, I've been drunk about 5 hours now.
Families are much more isolated. Individuals are much more isolated. And I do think a lot is lost.
I sat down with Noah Husson to talk about the film, The Bike Trip, and what it looks like to opt out of popular culture.
Well, my name is Noah. Noah Husson. Going back to the beginning, I was born in Pensacola, Florida, which I don't really have any memories of. Maybe a few flashbulb ones. Maybe I fabricated them because I moved down to the Tampa area in Florida at a very young age, 1.5 years old, and I kind of grew up in the suburbs down there. One brother, one sister, parents who got divorced when I was like 10, you know, kind of a cliche, fractured suburban family upbringing. Lived in a end of a cul-de-sac, all the houses around us looked the same as ours. You got up, got in a car whenever we wanted to go anywhere, to buy our food at the grocery store, turned on the TV or the radio when we wanted to hear music. didn't really have much of a connection to these things. We consumed them all from a distance. And then I went to college. In University of Florida, I studied psychology and philosophy. I kind of just wanted to understand myself and people. You know, I learned the most out of college, of course, about people. And that's, I guess, what brought me on this bike trip, is the same kind of drive that made me want to study.
So can you tell me about that, about the bike trip?
So I was living in Berlin, Germany. I was there on a Fulbright scholarship and then working as a counselor with youth. And my brother, he was in the Northeast United States, in New York and Washington, D.C. He was working as a photojournalist. And we'd been kicking around this idea for a long time, even really since we were together growing up as kids, about going off on a road trip and telling stories together. It's kind of like trying to find parts of the United States that felt good to us, that inspired us, that kind of, so we could like live through whatever romantic ideas of the country we had through listening to music from the 60s or like reading whatever literature seemed so far removed from what we were in our version of America. So we decided to do it on bikes, basically. That seemed like the most appropriate way. And I left Berlin for that. I flew back to this country. And my brother and I met up in Asheville, North Carolina, with this loose framework of an idea, you know, find some kind of alternative America, find an America where people are trying to get back to themselves, back to community, back to the land, back to the more visceral aspects of life that we've kind of systematically removed ourselves from through the industrialization and suburbanization of this country. So that was the concept. I mean, we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into.
So what kind of people did you meet along the way?
Well, we met all kinds of people. We met far and away, like, most people we met were just ordinary, traditional, rural Americans. Because, I mean, this is a big country. There's a lot of space between cities. And when you're on a bicycle, you feel every single mile that you go. And, you know, every corner store you is a conversation, because you're these weird-looking foreigners on bikes, and everyone wants to know what you're doing, where you're coming from. So, I mean, most of the people were just your well-meaning, conservative, rural Southerners. We were actively seeking out, though, slightly more radical, progressive-minded people, I guess you could say, who were very active,